Started. So as I mentioned last time, we have actually finished most of the chapters from the book. So today and next time I'm going to talk about some advanced topics. Today's class is going to be on sensor networks. Next time we will do mobile computing and multimedia systems. Okay, so these are the three topics. So what I'm going to do in this class is give you an introduction of what's a sensor network, what are building blocks of a sensor network, what is it used for, and so on. Okay, so we'll talk about platforms, applications. I'll mention a few canonical problems that arise in this area, give a few examples, and also talk about some systems that have been built for these sensor networks. So, quick introduction of what is a sensor network. So, this is basically a network of distributed sensors that can sense what is happening in the environment and relay their observations to some users or applications that are interested in them. So, what is being shown here are several scenarios where sensor networks are useful. Okay, so, this is a surveillance and tracking example. So, it could be a highway that is an intelligent highway that's monitoring flow of traffic, trying to figure out where congestion occurs, or it could be some other scenario. But there are these sensors that are deployed, okay, and they're trying to figure out when, in this case, it's tracking vehicles. But you could have other types of sensors that track people or animals or what have you. Okay. So these sensors are deployed and they can sense what is around their environment. And as and when they see objects or events of interest, they will do something. And the most simple thing they do is relay this observation to some central location. Okay, but they could process this observation locally or coordinate with other sensors to figure out what to do whenever something interesting happens. So here is another example of environmental monitoring. So here the sensors are deployed, in this case in a forest, and they are sensing, let's say, moisture or humidity, temperature, variety of things that you may want to figure out, or air quality perhaps, to understand. And then this data is then used by scientists to answer a variety of scientific questions on maybe climate change or impact of certain factors on the environment or the local ecosystem and so on. Okay, and the picture, the third picture here shows seismic monitoring. So in this case, what people have done is they have deployed sensors to detect earthquakes, to get early warnings on earthquakes. There are even sensors deployed on the ocean floor to detect tsunamis. Okay, in Asia, where this is a bigger problem, the earthquakes on the floor of the ocean that can trigger these tidal waves that can cause a lot of destruction. So there are systems, sensor-based systems that are deployed to provide early warning. Okay, so this one does seismic monitoring and structural monitoring. So specifically, it's not trying to detect earthquakes, but it's trying to detect the impact of earthquakes on the health of a building. Okay, so it's actually doing structural monitoring to see if the foundations have collapsed or is it okay. Okay, so there are a variety of applications like this that are being used. And what is new here is that this has been going on for a long time. It's not that some of this has certainly become feasible. But what is new in the context of what we are interested in is the ability to network the sensors for real-time data access as well as queries. Okay? So people have deployed sensors for a long time, for several decades. But what the main problem was, these sensors were typically not networked. Okay? With the advent of these wireless networks and wireless radios, you can actually put these platforms and connect them to sensors and see what is happening out in the field in real time. And that is what a network of these sensors allows you to do. So let's start with the platform. Okay, now, so what is a sensor network platform and why is it different? So at its very basic essence, a sensor network platform is nothing but a small embedded computer. Okay? It has a processor, it has some memory, it has some ability to communicate, typically using a wireless radio. Okay. Now, what is different between a platform like this and a typical PC or a desktop or a laptop is that this is a very resource-constrained device. Okay. First of all, these devices tend to be battery-powered. Okay. They are not connected to an AC source. Okay. This is primarily because you want to go back to a forest and do some environmental monitoring. It is unlikely that you will find a plug to that you can plug your sensor to, right? Because there is no infrastructure, there is no network. So you have to run these devices on battery power. They may just use a battery, or they may use some energy harvesting where the battery is rechargeable and it runs on solar power. But regardless, they are battery powered, okay, which means energy is an issue. Okay, same thing with laptops. If you are traveling on a plane and there is no availability of power, then you have to conserve your battery power so you get your work done and not drain the battery. Okay. The second difference is they use low power radios for wireless communication. Okay. So these sensors need to communicate. Your sensor platform need to communicate, so they use a wireless radio. Now, since they are battery powered, this wireless radio needs to be very efficient. So it is a low power radio, and that has some that brings up some issues that we'll talk about. Okay. The third thing that's different is, since I mentioned it's resource constraint, they use small embedded microcontrollers. So CPU is very small as compared to Intel based or AMD class processors. These are typically eight bit or smaller. Microcontrollers, they have very little memory, so they are highly resource constrained and they don't have a lot of processing power. Okay. The fourth difference is if these devices have storage, that tends to be flash storage. Okay, we'll talk more about flash storage. So these flash storage is the same kind of chips that you put into a digital camera. Okay, they don't have hard disks or anything like that. They have smaller amounts of storage, which tends to be flash based. Okay. The third thing, the last thing, is these devices, embedded controllers, are connected to a sensor. That's the reason you put them out. Okay, so the sensors are producing data that is actually being acquired by this device and being sent out. Okay. Any questions on this? So we'll talk about each of this next. We'll start with the battery and then communication and whatnot. Okay. So this is an example, this picture here, which is this device here. Is an example of what is called a Telos mode. Okay, this is an instantiation of a sensor platform. Okay, and the specs are actually shown for the battery in this case. So this runs on a AA battery. Okay, you can of course connect other batteries to it, but you just put a AA battery. It has a CPU and a memory and a wireless radio and so on. Okay, and then this thing is yet another device like that. Okay. So they run on AA batteries, and typically what that means is for this device you get about 4 days. If the device is on all the time, you get about 4 days of on time, and then the battery drains. So if you are going to deploy this, your experiment better run within 4 days, or you have to use some smarter energy management scheme where you turn the node off when it's not doing anything useful. This is referred to as duty cycling. Okay, by turning the nodes on and off dynamically, okay, or periodically, depending on when something interesting is happening, you can extend the lifetime of a network, okay, so that the battery doesn't drain. Okay, the network lifetime is defined to be the time for which the network remains up, okay, meaning that the battery is still alive and so on. Now, you could, of course, put bigger batteries, or you could use what is called energy harvesting, where you use solar power to recharge the batteries and so on. That will all extend the lifetime of the network. But nevertheless, if you want to put out a small device, you're constrained. Yes, question there.
So you have a figure for system consumption. So like lifetime when everything's on. If it's sleeping for almost all the time, like how much? How would you expect the consumption?
Right. So I will talk more about that. That's the problem of duty cycling here. So the question that is being raised is this lifetime is when the node remains up all the time. What if it is shut down or I are put to sleep and you only bring it up when needed? What does that mean imply in terms of the lifetime? So if you do that, the lifetime can be extended. It all depends on what is called a duty cycling rate. Okay, this is the fraction of the time the node is up. So if you use 1% duty cycle, that means the node is up only 1% of the time over some period. Okay, and it's down from 99, down as in sleeping for much of the time. So if you do things like this, you can have lifetimes of weeks or months. Okay, so it all depends on the duty cycling rate. Here, if you have 100%, as in it's always up, then you get something low.
Yeah. Sorry, my question was actually what sort of consumption you would expect to see when it's in sleep mode? Like, what fraction?
Oh, I see. What fraction? Okay, so the question is something different. So how much is the energy consumption when it's asleep, right? So it depends on what sleep mode you use. There are different types of sleep modes, even on a laptop, for example. So there are modes where you could completely shut the node down, okay, in which case it's not going to consume any power. You need a way to bring it back up, of course. But there are other modes where, let's say, you turn the radio off or you put the radio in what's called low power listen. Okay. And depending on exactly what sleep mode you use, it can go down to microamps. Is that right? Right. So it's basically less than one. It can reduce to less than a milliamp. Okay. And this all depends on what components on the node are up. So the CPU, let's say, is put to sleep, but you may keep the RAM refreshed, or you could keep the radio in low power mode, or you can turn the radio off. The same kind of energy management, any device, a laptop has to do the same thing. It could turn the display off, for example, but the CPU may stay on. Or it could turn the CPU off, so you will get different sleep modes. And that will impact the power consumption. Okay. So the next component that we'll look at is the radio. Okay, so each of these needs to have a wireless radio for communication. Okay, so this is another node, and this is an antenna that's connected to the radio on this node. Okay, and then each of these has a wireless radios. Yes. Now they all tend, the common thing across them is they all tend to be low power, okay, and the reason for this is most of these devices run on batteries, so you can't connect a high powered radio because that will drain the battery. Okay, example of higher powered radios are 802.11 radios, your Wi-Fi radios that are on laptops and so on. They are higher powered. Okay, you can run them on batteries, but they'll drain the battery very quickly. So these have much lower power consumption as compared to these more conventional radios. Okay, but also there is a trade-off. Okay, because they're low power, either they will be lower bit rate or smaller range. Okay, meaning either the bandwidth is going to go down because you're using lower power, or the range is going to be lower. Okay, there's a trade-off. You can actually pick a radio depending on what exactly you want. So several examples. There's the most common one is what is called a Zigbee radio. Okay, this is called 802.15. It's an analog of or a sister standard to 802.11, which is Wi-Fi. Okay, this is meant for shorter range wireless communication, just as Bluetooth is also a short range wireless communication protocol. The same thing is true here. It's lower power but shorter range. Okay, the bandwidth you get is hundreds of kilobits per second, in contrast to 802.11 where you get megabits per second. Right? So there's a big difference in what you use it for. Yes, question. Is there a possibility of a collision? Is that what? Yes. Yes. So question. Let me answer your question in two ways. I'm not sure which of the two questions you're asking. So you're asking, is there a possibility of a collision? Okay. Now, if there are two, if they are the same radio and that same radio transmit, they will collide, obviously. But you can also have interference across radios if they are running on the same frequency band. Right. So you could have 802.11 running on the 2.4 gigahertz band and some other low power radio that's also using the same band. Okay. And then if there is, they can interfere with one another. They cannot communicate, but they can certainly interfere with one another. So collisions because of simultaneous transmission or interference across different devices is a way of life. If you use an unlicensed band like 2.4 gigahertz, when you don't even need a radio, if you actually have a cordless phone, okay, or you just turn on your microwave, okay, it's going to start interfering because that is in the 2.4 gigahertz band. Right, so you will always have these problems. That's never going to go away. Okay. Typical ranges are short for these devices, less than 100 meters, But there are radios that also go much longer. So this is also a wireless sensor network platform, and it has a radio that can go up to a kilometer at very low bit rates, bit rates of kilobits a second, or tens of kilobits a second. You'll get much longer range. If you actually try to use higher bit rate, you get shorter and shorter ranges. Okay, so it allows you to trade off range and bandwidth. Okay. So this is this particular manufacturer, the CC2420, which is an example of a Zigbee radio. So you can see why it's low power, because it takes milliamps to transmit and receive. Okay, so it's much lower power than what a typical 802.11 radio would take. Yes.
Sorry. So underwater, radio doesn't carry as well, right? It needs something other than.
Yes. Good question. So if the question is underwater, what would you do? So if you wireless communication underwater is basically more or less impossible. Yeah, this is because the water characteristics are such that the attenuation is going to reduce the range of your wireless radio to few feet, okay, from several hundred meters. So if you have nodes that are spread across, you're not going to be able to do this. So what you do underwater is you use acoustic radios. Okay, so acoustics is basically using sound as opposed to wireless communication. So you use, and there you get even lower bit rates, okay, than what these radios would give you. The range is higher, but yeah, you would not use this underwater for sure. This is all terrestrial. Any other questions here?
The applications that actually interpret these bits that are coming along, is there the whole stack, or I mean, do they just interpret the raw bits
okay.
coming in?
So question is, how are they going to interpret the bit? So we'll look at all of that. Okay, when I talk about the operating system and the protocol stack, we'll talk a little bit about this. Yeah, but there has to be some protocol stack. You can't do everything in the application. That's the short answer. Okay. Now, the last component on these things is the processor itself. Okay, you'll see that this processor is much lower capacity and much more resource constrained than typical one. So this, the one on the device I just showed, it's an 8-bit processor. It has 4 kilobytes of RAM. Okay, only 4 KB memory. Not even megabytes. It's kilobytes of RAM. There is flash, which allows you to keep your code. Okay, this is equivalent to what you would have on a disk. All your programs are on disk, and when you load them, they load into RAM. So you have slightly bigger storage space to keep all your programs or code, but the RAM is very small. So that means your entire application, whatever you write, and an operating system, if one exists, has to all fit in 4 kilobytes. So this makes programming these devices is sort of very different from writing a program for a typical PC or a server class device. Okay. And then it is basically running at 8 megahertz. Okay. The processor is also very slow. It's an 8 megahertz processor. And on desktop class machine, you get gigahertz processor. So three orders of magnitude, two orders of magnitude lower in terms of its clock speed, and certainly much smaller RAM. Only does 8-bit as opposed to 64-bit and so on. Okay. And there are other devices which are slightly different, but they are all in the same ballpark. And there are some slightly higher power processors. So these are embedded microcontrollers. There are PDA class processors on some devices, okay, which are still much lower capacity than laptop or desktop class processors. These are examples of 32-bit processors that are PDA class. Okay. But the basic point is, it's much more resource-constrained device. Okay, that's the thing to keep in mind. Let's ignore the block diagram of the processor there. Okay, and the last thing is the storage on this device. Okay, so they have to have some storage to keep the data and the code and so on. And this is typically done using flash storage. Okay, flash storage is, as I mentioned already, these are the chips that you put in your digital camera or other devices. Yeah, they're called compact flash. Or some version of flash. There are many variants. There's something called a NOR flash, which is more appropriate for programs. There's something called a NAND flash, which is more appropriate for data. What you typically get for your cameras is basically NAND flash. Okay, this is also a removable media. You know, most of these things that you actually get for a camera is the flash storage itself, as well as a microcontroller. Not a microcontroller, a controller to allow you to access the flash. Okay. On most of these devices, you only have the storage part. The controller is actually written in software in some sense. Okay. Now, what is different between flash storage and other devices? A, first thing is it's very low power. Okay. There are no moving parts. It's all solid state. So reading and writing to flash is much cheaper than reading or writing to disk, which has a splatter that's spinning all the time. Okay, so in terms of power consumption, it is very, very efficient, which means it's suitable for battery-powered devices. Okay. But there are some idiosyncrasies. Okay. This device is not similar to what you expect in a disk, in a hard disk, for example. Okay. The biggest difference is that once you write to a particular location on flash, you cannot overwrite that location. Okay. It's typically a write-once device. So you have to do what is called an erase in order to overwrite. Okay. On a disk, if you want to write to a block, you can write to it as many times as you want. You can just go and overwrite that block. The new block will just replace what was already stored. You cannot do that here. Okay. If you start from an empty flash and if you write to what's called a page, which is a block on flash, okay, once you do that, you cannot rewrite. Okay. You have to erase the whole page using what's called an erase cycle. Okay, and then you can write to it again. So it's a write once device, which is something very different from most of the other devices you have seen. Okay, this makes storage management different. Okay, so if you update a file, for example, you can't go and write to it at the same location, you write to it elsewhere. And then you go and erase the previous location. Okay, is this clear? What's the main difference between flash and a disk? That's the main thing to keep in mind. The rest of it is somewhat similar. Okay, so you need to do garbage collection. If you keep updating data, you have all these pages that are outdated because you have returned those pages to a new location. Okay, so you need to garbage collect and do things like what we talked about in the log structured file system, okay, compact and so on. Okay, so the last thing is, these devices are just computational nodes. So you have to connect them to some sensors which are actually doing the sensing for you and producing the data. And there are many kinds depending on what your application does, right? So this lists a whole bunch of them, starting from temperature, humidity. Okay. Could have vibration sensors that you put on a road to detect vehicles and so on. Okay. You could have acoustic sensors to detect sound, light sensors. Okay. Could have imaging sensors like cameras. So here is an example of one. Imaging sensor. So this has a small camera on it, very low power camera. Okay, it's like a cell phone class camera. The kind of small cameras you have on cell phone. This actually looks bigger than that, but there are smaller versions of this. Okay. So this is a low power camera. You connect this to one of these devices and it can take pictures. It's also battery powered. It will take pictures for you and you can do image processing on the board itself. It has some onboard image processing features. And then you can have other things like GPS and so on these devices. Okay. So you can connect a variety of sensors to these things. Okay. So this very quick primer tells you what a node is. Okay. It doesn't tell us anything about the network. So this says we have a small processor, very small amounts of RAM, okay, flash storage to store data and or programs. And then you connect a sensor to this thing. Okay. That makes a single node. Now, there are many of these that you would deploy. Okay, that will make and there's, of course, the wireless radio. Then there are many of these that you would deploy, which makes a network of these. Okay, so that's what is shown in this picture. Okay, so this is a typical deployment, which is what also called a sensor application. So you deploy a number of these nodes. Okay, and there are sensors connected to them. Each is going to do some sensing in its vicinity. It's producing data depending on the sensing rate. And then you have the whole point of the deployment is you want to do something with the data that is being observed. Okay, so you could have a temperature sensor or image sensor that just monitors an environment, for example. Okay. Typically, you have what is called a sensor gateway or a base station. That is the entry point to this sensor network. Okay. And this base station may then itself be connected to the internet. Okay. We'll talk about how you access these devices and so on. Okay, so here is basically some applications that are running on some remote machine and there is some data centralized store for storing all of the data. So the assumption is data is actually flowing from these devices to some central location and applications accessing it. This is one model for building a sensor network. Okay. Okay. In this case, each of these nodes acts as simple data collection devices. Okay, they're just collecting data and sending them somewhere. Okay, and it is stored in some central location. All of the processing and so on actually happens on regular machines. Okay, and you're just getting data from these devices. Okay. There's another model that people have proposed. In this case, the intelligence is all outside the sensor network. Okay, this is the sensor network. This is the rest of your network. Okay. And the intelligence, there is no intelligence here. These are simple, dumb data collection devices. Okay. There's another model which says, let's put more intelligence on these devices. Okay. Let them not be just data collection devices, but they can do some simple processing. Not a lot of complicated processing because they don't have the processing power to do it, but you can do simple things. Okay. So in this model, what would happen is each of these devices would not only collect data, but they would also answer queries for the data. So data is assumed to be stored locally or sent to some local microserver, and it is stored there. And whenever an application needs to access the data, since the data is now not in a central location, but is distributed across multiple nodes in the network, any access to this data requires queries or read requests that actually go inside the network to fetch the data or do processing of the data inside the network. So here there is some computation that is happening inside the network. So there is no, it's not just a data collection device anymore. Okay, so there are these two models. Depending on whether you want to put intelligence inside or outside, you can design or architect your network in different ways. Okay, but all that said, a sensor network is still very much a data driven application. Okay, because all of the sensors are producing data. So you have to gather this data somewhere, process it, and answer queries or provide application access to this data. Okay, so that's data collection, fusion, and transport problems. Okay. So with that background, now what we will look at are several canonical problems that arise in a sensor network. To design any sensor application, you have to solve some of these problems. Otherwise, you will not be able to do what you need. Okay, so there's localization, synchronization, routing, duty cycling, and data aggregation. Okay, so let's look at, and some of these we have already encountered. If you remember when we did our chapter 4 or chapter 5, we had several of these issues that came up. Okay, the same, this is after all a distributed system, so some of these problems are going to be the same as any other distributed system. So first problem is localization. Okay, what does this mean? Localization is the problem of finding the location of a node. Okay. Now, why is this required, or why is this even a problem to begin with? So, if you think about it, what do you do when you want to deploy a sensor application? You will take some of these nodes, okay, and then you will connect a sensor. Maybe it's a camera, maybe it's something else. Then you go and deploy it somewhere. Maybe you go into a forest and you deploy 25 nodes. And you deploy them at various locations. Okay, now when the node comes up, or you boot up this node, it doesn't know where it is or what it's supposed to do. Right? So the first thing it has to do is figure out its own location relative to other nodes in the network. So this could be either an absolute location, like a GPS location, or relative location, saying there are four other nodes in my vicinity. And you need to do this in order to communicate. Okay, if you're going to collect data and send it, you will typically not send data in one hop. You will relay it through other nodes. Okay, because the base station, as I've shown here, okay, the base station is here. Okay, and there is this node which may be far off from the base station. So its wireless radio cannot send data to the base station in one hop. Okay, so this is a multi-hop network where you are sending data to a neighbor and the neighbor is relaying. In this case, it's a two-hop network, but you could have arbitrary number of hops. Okay? To do this, you need to know who your neighbors are. Okay? And when you boot up, you have to configure yourself. Figure out, I have three neighbors and these are where the neighbors are. To do that, you need to localize yourself. Okay? So you need to know where you are and where your neighbors are. So this is the problem of localization. Okay? Is this clear what the problem is? Now, how do you go about figuring out your location?
You need to send reference points.
Right. So you need reference points. You could just do GPA, what GPS does. Okay. So say it's not my problem, I'm going to use GPS, it already knows how to do it. Okay. So certainly you could do that, but then you have to put a GPS receiver on this thing. And that may or may not be feasible for a number of reasons. Okay, A, there is higher cost. The GPS device is not cheap. Okay, it increases the cost. GPS devices draw a lot of power. Okay, so it's going to consume power. And last problem is if you want to do this one time and the network comes up, then the GPS receiver is effectively useless after that unless you move this node. Right, because you figure out its location. If it is stuck to a tree, it's not going to move. So once you figure that out, that device that you just put on it is basically not useful until you move it and or use it for another application. Okay. So there are several reasons why you may or may not use GPS. Okay, some other issues are if you do an indoor sensor network, if you want to deploy a network inside a building for any reason, GPS doesn't work because you can't see a satellite inside a building. The satellite signals are not going to propagate through physical structures. Okay, so there are scenarios where GPS signal may not even be available, but even if it is available, there are reasons why you may or may not use it. Okay. So there are a number of other techniques that have also been designed. If you don't want to use GPS, then what would you do? Okay. The basic idea is same in all of these techniques. You are going to do, have some reference points or reference beacons, and you localize yourself with respect to those. Okay. The same idea as GPS, that the basic idea hasn't changed. Except that you may or may not use a GPS receiver and satellites as your beacon, you may use some other beacon. So here you are showing three base stations. These are, and then there's a device that is localizing itself with relative to these three base stations. So these base stations know where they are. They are sending these reference beacons, the same thing that you do in GPS. And this device is listening and it's figuring, triangulating itself with respect to these three base stations to figure out its location. So you could basically, in theory, just use your own wireless radio and listen to base station broadcasts and localize yourself relative to the base station. Yeah, so you don't know an absolute location, or maybe you do, the base station know their absolute location, but you know your location relative to the base stations. Okay. So there are many ways to do this. I mean, people use signal strength, or if you have synchronization, you can use the time of flight, which is what GPS also uses. And there are many other techniques. So there's a whole area of research on how to do good localization. Yeah, there are many, many techniques out there. But once you know how any one works, the basic idea is similar, but they differ in their exact techniques. Okay. So I already mentioned some of this. GPS is expensive. Okay. Now, regardless of what you do, the localization accuracy is not great. Even for GPS, GPS has accuracy of tens of meters. Okay, if you use the commercial one, there are military versions of GPS that gives you accuracy of a meter or less. The commercial is like 10 meters. Okay. Now, the reason this works when you have a GPS in an automobile is because it makes some assumptions. It assumes that your car actually drives on a road. Okay, so what it does is typically once you localize yourself, it tries to figure out where is the nearest road. Because the location that you localize may be actually some meters away from the road, but it may use some heuristics to figure out that you are actually driving on some road, and that's the reason it typically gets it right. If you need any better accuracy than tens of meters, GPS is the wrong way to go. You have to use other techniques to do the same thing. Okay, so first problem is localization. The next problem is time synchronization. This also we have seen already. Okay, and we did canonical problems. So there are many reasons you want to synchronize these nodes. Okay, for all of the reasons we have looked at before. But this, the sensor network aspect also brings up one additional reason that synchronization is very important. Okay, it turns out that in case of a sensor network, synchronization is necessary for wireless communication. This is because since these nodes are battery powered, they are duty cycle. Okay, duty cycle basically means it's going to go down for some time. It's going to sleep, then wake up. Okay. So the simplest form of duty cycling is periodic. So let's assume it wakes up for 10 seconds every 10 minutes. Okay, so the node is going to look like this, right? So this is time. And this shows whether it's what its state is. Okay, this is sleep, this is up. And then it sleeps for 9 minutes 50 seconds and then it comes back up, stays up for 10 seconds and goes back down. Okay. Now it can do interesting work, be it computation or communication, only when it is up. Okay, that's clear. If it's sleeping, it's not really doing anything. Now, if this node wants to send a power, do wireless communication, let's say it wants to send a packet to its neighbor. Okay, if these two nodes are not synchronized, they may never be able to communicate. Why is that? If they're not synchronized and they come up at arbitrary time, the neighbor actually comes up when you are sleeping and you come up when your neighbor is sleeping, then you may send packet when you are awake. The neighbor is asleep, he's not going to receive the packet. Packet is dropped. Right? So now you cannot communicate. So the reason you want synchronization is if you do synchronization and then you agree saying let's both come up at the same time because our clocks are synchronized, we agree we are going to come up at this time. Or at the hour you come up for a few minutes, then the chances of you and your neighbor coming up at the same time is high. Okay, then you need synchronization for at the radio level as well, but this is just one example of why you may want to keep the node synchronized. Okay, is this clear? So you need to synchronize, and then how do you do this? Okay, so you can use all of the techniques we talked about before. So this only needs relative synchronization, clearly. It doesn't need absolute because it is trying to synchronize itself with the neighbor. Okay, so long as your clock and the neighbor's clock agree and you both come up at the same time, you are done. Right, so you need to figure out drift and all of that stuff. So you can use some variant of the Berkeley algorithm. Okay, so you need, so this is just showing you what it does, which is exactly what the Berkeley algorithm does. So here you basically sample your own time, okay, and then you send it to your neighbor B, okay, and then the B is going to account for software delays, the network propagation time, and then it will also account for some clock drift based on what you are seeing and what your neighbor is seeing. Okay, and then it will adjust its clock. That's all this is saying, although it looks very complicated. It's basically just doing what the Berkeley algorithm did, okay, with some additional parameters. Okay. There are various forms of synchronization. You could do, if there's one sender, multiple receivers, you could synchronize the receivers or you could synchronize the sender or the receiver. It doesn't matter. I mean, all of the basic issue is you need some form of synchronization. And there are any synchronization algorithm, time synchronization algorithm that we have studied will work. If there's an external network source for this sensor network, then you can also get synchronized with respect to real time. This may be needed for some reasons. Okay, so if you say, I want to sense the temperature at noon, okay, the sensor better know what noon is. If it has a clock that is running by itself without any notion of what real time is, it will not be able to give you the right answer. Okay, so sometimes you may need external reference as well. But for things like communication, you only need relative reference. Okay, so there are these things to keep in mind. Okay. Now the third problem is routing. Okay. And routing is simply the problem of one sensor node being able to route its packet to another sensor node at a very basic level. Now there are several problems that will arise here that we will not encounter in the traditional networks. Okay. The first is most of these networks have nodes that do not have this notion of an IP address. Because this node is not running TCP/IP. TCP/IP is too heavy duty a protocol stack for such a small node. Okay. So how do you even address a node? Right? So in the regular internet, if you want to talk to a particular machine, you just get its IP address and you talk to that machine. Okay. How do I say that I want data from this device and not the other device? There has to be a way to name these devices. Okay, that's the first problem in routing is naming. You have to have an address. So each of these will have some address. Okay, but this has to make sense to an application. Right? So there are various forms of naming or addressing that is used. One is location based. Okay, depending on where you deploy this, that's the name you give it. So you could say this is, let's suppose you're deploying it in a building. Say, I want data from the sensor that is on the north side of the building. Okay, that's how you are naming this device. So the device needs to know it is on the north side, but this query will actually flow to that right device, and you get data from it. The other way is to actually name the data as opposed to the location, where you basically say, I want this type of data. Okay? And then anyone who has that type of data will actually send you the results. So assuming you have some way of naming your nodes, then the next question is, how do you actually get data from these nodes, or how do you send requests to that node? That's the problem of routing. Okay? And the basic issue is that these nodes form a multi-hop wireless network. If there was just one base station and there were some nodes that were all one hop away, there's no routing problem. The base station just broadcasts. I mean, any packet it sends out is a broadcast, because in the wireless network, everything is basically just going out on the channel. Because you just send out the request and each node listens for any data meant for it, and it will get that. Okay, but if you have a wireless network, then you have to figure out where to send the data, which neighbor is going to relay this data. Same problem as regular routing, but now how do you do this in the context of wireless sensor network, where you have names based on either geography or data as opposed to names that are based on IP addresses. In IP address routing, you use prefix-based routing, right? So that's how you actually route. Question is, how do you do that here? So there are many variants. Okay, so then there are these other problems in context of routing, which is, let's suppose you want to send data from this node to this node. Okay, if the middle node is sleeping, you are going to be stuck. So in this case, if there is an alternate path which may be longer, then you may still have to use it if this node is either sleeping or has low battery power, so it cannot really participate. Okay. So there are these other constraints that come into play, not just what is the shortest path to send data from node A to node B in your sensor network. It also depends on, does the path have nodes that have sufficient energy, or the nodes going to be up, and so on. Okay. So let me talk about this. Now, typically, let me draw a picture here. If you architected your sensor network as a data collection network, that was the first architecture I mentioned, okay, it is sufficient to just organize your network as a tree with the base station as the sink. Okay, so basically, you have a sensor network, and this is your base station. And these are nodes that are just deployed. This is the sensor node that are deployed. That's your base station. And if this is a data collection network, the most common form of communication is every time this node senses some data or some number of, it takes some number of readings, it is going to just send that to the base station. Okay? And then the base station will actually send it to some central repository where it is stored. Okay? So the easiest way to do this is to organize these nodes in the form of a data collection tree. So in this case, all you do is the routing is as simple as sending all of your observations to your parent, and the parent does the same thing, and data just flows up the tree to the base station, and from there it just goes to the regular internet wherever it needs to go. Okay, so there are many tree-based routing schemes that are used. Okay, so sending of data is basically you just go up a tree. Now if you have to communicate in the other direction for any reason, okay, this may or may not, this topology may or may not work. So what is typically done is, the other common thing is flooding. Okay, in flooding, you basically send the packet to all of your neighbors send it to all of their neighbors. So typically it reaches everything, every node in the network, which is very wasteful. But it will also get to the node that you intend to send it to. Okay, yes, question. Question is, how did this tree get constructed? Was it statically designed, or did it organize itself? So there are protocols that will do both. The simplest way is if you actually know the deployment topology. That you know, I'm going to deploy this on the north side of the building, this is on the south. So you can construct a static tree. Okay? That is simple because you know where you're deploying and that. But if you have a large number of nodes, it becomes complicated. So there are routing algorithms that will discover their neighbors and figure out who is closer to the sink and self-organize themselves. There are many, many protocols that do that. Okay, so you could either do the construct this tree statically or dynamically. Right? Dynamic schemes are good because if some of these nodes just go down because the battery died, then you have to reorganize the tree, otherwise the tree is going to get partitioned. Okay? Now that also brings a big interesting problem. If you have so I mentioned the tree-based routing and flooding are the two most common techniques. Okay, in flooding, every packet is broadcast. Okay, you just flood the network and it's intended for typically a single recipient, but it eventually gets there because you're flooding the network. Now, in context of tree-based routing, what should be clear is that nodes that are higher up in the tree, okay, will have more work to do. Yeah, because they are basically relaying, as you go higher up the tree, you are relaying data for more and more nodes. So you are basically relaying data for everyone in your subtree. Okay, so that also means that the battery on the nodes that are higher up on the tree drains faster because you are doing more wireless communication. So a leaf node only sends its own data. It never has to do any work for anyone else. Okay? This one is going to do its own work as well as work of relaying for its child and so on and so forth. So if you have a large tree, nodes higher up in the tree better have either bigger batteries or be more capable, okay? Because they will drain their batteries faster. So they have to communicate more than other nodes. Okay? And communication tends to be the most expensive operation on any of these nodes. Okay, it's far more expensive to use the wireless radio in terms of battery drain, okay, than it is to do any local computation or access storage. Okay, so all of the networks are optimized for communication as a result, because that is the thing that actually drains the battery the fastest. So that's what is being shown here, saying this sink has this, the packet rate here is 1 packet per second. In this one hop tree, the packet rate here is 4 packets per second, and that means that more battery drain. So I already mentioned this problem of duty cycling and synchronization. So that's the same picture I drew there. So here is the receiver, here is the transmitter. If you're sending when the receiver is completely asleep, it is not even going to listen to the data. But the other thing that you do if you are not synchronized is if you want to send, you basically keep sending a preamble until this guy eventually wakes up. Okay, so you're just sending something saying, I want to send something like some preamble on that line. And then eventually this guy is going to wake up and he's going to get some part of this, okay, transmission. Then he's going to figure out that the other node wants to send. And then he'll say, okay, I'm up. And at that point you send the data. Okay, so in the absence of synchronization, you just have to keep your radio up. If you are a sender, you have to keep your radio up sending something which is a preamble. Is announcing your intention to send until your neighbor eventually wakes up and acknowledges you. Okay. This would be enormously wasteful for heavily duty cycle networks, okay, because you potentially will have to keep your radio up until the next time your receiver wakes up. Okay. So which is why synchronization is much better. If you synchronize the nodes, you know when your the neighbor is going to wake up, so you wake up around the same time. Okay. And then start sending. So your preamble that you send to tell your neighbor you still want to send data is much smaller. Yeah, this is far more efficient if you do a little bit more work ahead of time and synchronize. That's what this slide is saying. Okay, is this clear? That you can communicate even without synchronization, but that's wasteful. Basically it says you stay up until your neighbor wakes. That's what it is saying. Okay. So there are many routing algorithms that have been designed, and I'm going to talk about two such algorithms. The first one is called directed diffusion. The other one is called gradient based. Okay. So directed diffusion is basically a publish subscribe type architecture. Okay, that we talked about publish subscribe already. So sensors publish new notifications. These are data observations. Event notification, I observed this new data. Okay, that's what your sensors are publishing. And applications or syncs of these subscribe to specific types. Saying I am interested in all of the data from the north sensors on the north side of the building, or I'm only interested in data when the temperature goes above 100 Fahrenheit. So you can subscribe based on whatever your interest set is. And then what the system does is it basically optimizes a path from every sensor to every source, or rather every source to every sink that has subscribed to it, which is gradient based. Okay. By gradient based, that means that whenever you go to the next hop in the path, it is somehow closer to the sink than not. Okay, so this is basically a gradient that you have in the network, which says go that way. Okay, that's the right way. So you may not go in the shortest possible path, but you are generally headed in the right direction because the gradient leads you towards the sink. That's the basic idea. We'll look at another example of gradient based routing. Okay. So effectively every sink, so there's a gradient from the entire network to the sink saying if data flows, if this is the sink, you basically say data needs to flow in that direction generally. So it may not go in the shortest path, it may detour somehow, but it will eventually get there. So that's the kind of idea that are used in these algorithms. Yes.
So routing is generally done by saying who you're addressing to, right?
Yes. So I will talk a little. So I won't finish. So we are doing exactly that. So I'm just explaining the idea, saying you're going to use gradient base. So let me give a little more details on how that is done and just elaborate on what was just said. So here is basically a sample publish subscribe. So you say you express an interest, saying I'm interested. So let's say it's a road-based sensor. It's trying to detect things that go on the road. Say I'm only interested in vehicles, trucks or cars or some such thing. And then you say sense every 20 milliseconds, send for 10 seconds, and this is the region of the road or the monitored network that I'm interested in. You specify some coordinates. Okay. So this is an interest pair, and then sensors that match this would have to send data to whichever sink subscribe to it. Okay. Now how is this done is the next issue. So whenever you have this interest, it is actually sent. So just 1 second. So this is gradient based routing. So you express your interest. Okay. And now so here is basically a scenario where the black arrow shows the exploratory request. Okay, this is my interest that I'm sending out to the network. The red arrow shows the gradient, which is basically the right path to get back to me. Okay. So that is basically going along the lines of what you said. So initially you try to discover what is the right path. The sinks, any sink that matches interest, you send it to me. This is done by sending out your request, and then it hits some of these nodes that have matching data. Okay, so these matching nodes say, okay, if I actually have to send data, how should I send it back to whoever asked me? So I go in the reverse direction. Okay, because if the interest came to me from my parent, he said that's the way I should send the data, so it actually goes back to the sink. So because it's assumed that your parent is actually closer to the sink than you are. This is why the data flew to you in that direction. Okay. So basically that forms what is called a gradient or a slope, which says that's the way the data needs to flow. This is not the shortest path because you haven't discovered the shortest path. This is just a path that you discovered based on initial flooding, but it is sort of acting like that. Okay. So once you have formed this gradient, then you basically send data along the red arrows so that it goes to the sink. Okay, does that answer your question now or no? Okay. Is this clear what gradient based routing does? Yes, question. Yes. Because the same interest may you are flooding, right? So it may come to you from multiple nodes. So if, for example, each packet has a hop count, that how many hops has it gone, if the same packet comes to you from multiple parents, you can figure out which parent sent the packet to you with the fewest hops. So that may be an indication of the shorter path. Right? So you will design your weights based on that. Okay? Okay. So the now what we have looked at is this sensor network as a simple data collection device where you form these trees and subscribe to events and so on. But I also mentioned at the very beginning that there is another way to design a network where you put more intelligence inside the network. Yeah, this allows the network to do simple processing of the data you're observing and not just send all, just send raw observations off to some central node and have that central node, which is powerful, do all of the processing for you. Okay. So in this case, what happens is that there is more intelligence. So it allows you to actually query the network directly. Okay. And there are systems that have been designed like TinyDB that will allow you to do this, where you send a query that looks like a SQL query. Okay, with some extensions where you say this is the sampling rate and here is a trigger and so on. So you are now not querying a single node like you say in a database, you query a database. Here you are querying a collection of devices, saying this is my query, run it and send me any matching data. Okay. So that's the main difference to keep in mind. So the data model is very different from a typical database in this case. So in a database, what happens is the following. Okay, so in the database, the data is static or may change, but let's assume data is stored in on a disk and queries arrive. Okay, and they access this data. Okay. The sensor network, okay, the query is specified ahead of time and data is arriving over time, okay, as new observations are being made. Okay, so you instantiate a query saying anytime you see an intruder in this area, alert me. Okay. This is a query that is going to run perpetually until you stop it. The sensor is going to sense the observation saying, what I've sent, does it match this query? Okay. If so, you actually send out a response to the query. If not, you continue processing the query. Okay. So in this query, the database queries arrive over time, the data is more or less there. Here the query is more or less specified ahead of time, is data that's arriving over time. So it's a very different architecture. Okay, for that's the first thing to keep in mind. This is also called stream processing, okay, where data is arriving as a stream and you're processing data as it arrives continuously. Okay, so that's one difference. The other difference is you are viewing the entire network as a single logical database. Okay, so this, all of these basically look like one logical database to the outside. Okay, so instantiate the query. Okay, and where matching data will be found, none of that is known ahead of time. If you just say, tell me when you, so let's suppose you're monitoring a forest, okay, looking for rare animals. Okay, so you can say, tell me whenever you see an elephant. Okay, you don't know where an elephant is going to be seen ahead of time. So the query has to run everywhere. Okay, so basically you're querying this entire network as if it was a single logical database, and a result will come to you based on wherever matching data is found. Okay, that is essentially what is shown there. The entire network is like a single infinitely long logical table that's continuously producing new data over time. Okay. And queries are pre-specified, and whenever something matches, a response comes out of the network. Okay. And the nodes have to do some processing to figure out if they have matching data. Okay, which is different from a data collection like system where the node just observe data and send it blindly. They don't do any processing. Here the query may be pre-specified and they have to actually run on these nodes. So they have to be sitting on these devices trying to see whenever you get a matching observation, does it match whatever the user has requested or the application has requested. Okay, so some processing inside the network happens in this architecture but not in the other one. Are these two clear, what we just talked about? Yeah. So there are a lot of details which I'm not going to go into because we don't have the time, and this probably doesn't have to go into that much detail. Okay, so let's skip a couple of slides here and just look at operating systems, and then I'm going to end there. Okay, so the last thing is that we'll talk about is how are these systems designed, how to write these applications and so on. Okay, most of these nodes are not going to run Windows for you, right? So they have a 4 kilobyte of memory. It's not going to run practically most of the operating systems you know. Okay. So they need special purpose embedded operating systems. So there's one called TinyOS. There are many actually. There's another one called SOS. And so these are very small operating systems. Okay. The operating system and the application must fit in 4 kilobytes, right? So the OS itself is very, very small. Okay. And the application and the OS basically have to both reside on the same processor in that small RAM. Okay. So these kinds of operating systems make very different assumptions from Linux or Windows or Mac or Solaris and so on. So this picture actually shows you some differences. Okay. So for example, there's no notion of loadable programs on TinyOS. There's no notion of even a process in some sense, okay, in the address space, because there isn't sufficient resources to run multiple programs. If you can run your one program in 4 kilobytes, you are basically lucky at that point. So there's no question of running multiple programs and doing multiplexing, at least on the smaller devices. There are some bigger ones that would actually run will support multi-programming and so on. Similarly, memory management, which I guess is here, okay, is almost non-existent. The application has to, because there's only 4 kilobytes of memory. There isn't much you can do at that point. So the memory management primitives are very trivial. Effectively, the application is managing all of the memory. In fact, there's very little distinction between the application and the OS. Everything just looks like one blob of code. This is like the DOS days. There was really no OS. I mean, there's only one address space. There's some things that were doing what the OS does and some blob of code that did what the application did. Right? So it's very similar to that. There's only one address space. So all memory management and everything the application designer has to figure out. Okay, it's not going to do for you. So very, very primitive support. Okay? There is some networking support because you have to talk to the radio. Okay, so there's a small protocol stack that will allow you to construct packets and send it out and do routing and so on, but nothing sophisticated. So very, very stripped down, bare bones operating system. Okay, there's some scheduling and timer type things that are supported. There's some communication support, IPC support, some networking support. And that's about it. And there are some drivers because you have to talk to devices. Okay, yes, question.
What do you mean by IPC in the context of TinyOS if there are no processes?
It's not real processing, so you should say. It's just a way to communicate or send a notion of a message.
Yeah, note to note.
So now if you program on these devices, okay, you have to use some non-standard programming language. So if you use TinyOS, the language of choice is what's called NestC. It looks like C, but it's not really C. It does some other things. Okay. And what it has is basically this notion of component. So each unit of code, it's called a component, so you have various components that do various things, and you sort of pool them together and you get an application with the OS components in there that will then run on this thing. Okay? And there are ways to connect components and have them talk to one another and so on. So component has some process commands that can throw events. So this is event-based programming, really. There's no threads or anything like that. So everything is an event, and you use the notion of event-based asynchronous. There's no notion of blocking and so on. It's an event-based programming, and you use tasks for concurrency. There are events and so on, and there are interfaces that each component exports that other components use. Okay. So that gives you some flavor of how to write a program, okay, on these things, because it has to be very compact, because it has to be very, very optimized for memory and also optimized for energy. That's the other thing you want to keep in mind. You don't want your program to consume a lot of energy and drain the battery. So now this is not very different from embedded device programming in general. Okay, programming any embedded device looks somewhat like this. It is not very similar to what you do when you program Linux or Windows. Okay, because you're much closer to the hardware. You really need to know what the hardware is. The OS doesn't support as much features. Okay? There are some more powerful embedded operating systems, but most of the stripped down ones don't give you all of the nice features you expect in a regular operating system. Okay. This is a graph of components which I'm going to ignore, but not in detail. So here is the boundary between the application and the operating systems. Here are components that basically do the protocol processing. Okay, this is basically a serial port. an RS that actually typically connects to the sensor itself. There is a clock, okay, and there's that the application is there. There's a routing thing that is routing component, there's routing data, and so on. So you have these components that are wired together in the form of a graph that basically is your entire blob of code that runs on the node. Okay, so let's skip the rest. Okay, so to wrap up, the take home message from this course should be that sensor networks are useful for a variety of monitoring tasks, okay, monitoring the environment of some sort. Typically, but not always, these sensors are connected to nodes that are very resource constrained. Okay, nodes are deployed in environments where there is no infrastructure, there is no AC power, there's no cellular network that you can tap onto and things like that. So you have to basically make your node energy aware. You have to basically build your own wireless network to do this monitoring using the sensor nodes and so on. Okay. And at the end of the day, the whole network looks like a distributed system of interacting components. Okay. Each component is basically a node. They're all working together to achieve some common tasks. Okay. So it's a resource-constrained distributed system. Okay, and many of the problems are no different from a regular distributed system, like your localization, time synchronization, need to route, you need to communicate, and so on. So all of those problems are similar, okay, but the constraints requires tweaking the solution to match what the application and the platform need. Okay. Operating systems tend to be very lightweight because the devices are very resource constrained. Now, just to give a slightly different example, so you don't go away thinking all sensor networks are built like this, there are more powerful nodes, more powerful sensors that don't look like this. Okay, these are sort of what are low-power wireless sensor networks. There's an entire class of sensor networks called rich sensor networks that make a completely different set of assumptions. So these sensors produce very high bandwidth data. Okay. Sensors are very powerful, so they're typically deployed in places where there is AC power, you know, so, and they produce a lot of data. So the processing nodes are PC class or embedded PC class devices, okay? But they are not deployed as densely because these are larger nodes. You may not have the same density. You may have these nodes once every few kilometers or some such thing. Example of this is a radar sensor network, okay? So if you see the kind of radars that are used by weather by TV stations to actually get the weather in the environment, right, to tell you when you're going to see rain or snow or some such thing. These are much bigger sensors. Okay, they're very powerful. They cost tens of thousands of dollars. So each sensor is very expensive. So you don't put these kinds of nodes on them. If you're spending $30,000 to buy your radar, you can spend $2,000 to buy a PC to connect to it. Right, so if you have those kinds of sensor networks, they just look like a regular distributed system. I mean, they will run PC class operating system. They will have much more powerful capabilities. Okay? There is no difference except that the data is being generated continuously. So you have to have some data processing applications and tasks in the network. Those don't look different. These look very different, these resource constrained sensor networks. Okay? So I didn't talk about these latter class, but I just wanted to mention it before I wrap up so you don't get a very skewed view of what sensor networks look like. So they have different classes. What we have talked about is these low power ones. Okay, so let's stop there. And then next time, I will talk about mobile computing and multimedia.